Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This past August 1st was the 50th anniversary of what is considered the first mass university shooting in the United States. A former U.S. Marine named Charles Whitman climbed the tower building of the University of Texas with a rifle and killed 17 people, including an unborn child, and wounded 30 others before police killed him. I was in Vietnam that year, 1966, busy with my USMC colleagues eco-genociding Vietnamese culture, village by village. Yet we were shocked at Whitman's killing spree, worried that we ourselves might crack if we survived the war and do something similar. When I got back from Vietnam the following year, it seemed as though everyone with an abundance of guns thought I would be interested to see their collections, and most of them boasted their weapons were just the ticket for killing gooks and commies, quote and unquote. A short time afterward, when I lived in North Dakota as a reporter for Associated Press, I was invited on a prairie duck hunt by some of Fargo's prominent huntsmen who compared their shooting of unarmed birds with combat against the Viet Cong. My lasting impression of that hunt is of corpulent Elmer Fudds armed with blunderbusses, noisily stalking through tall grass and elusive prey none were able to get close enough to shoot. Before the police killed Whitman, several self-appointed posse wannabes showed up in pickup trucks with hunting rifles. It literally was a gun battle that went on, people screaming and shouting and ducking and running and hiding, gunshots echoing through the buildings on the campus, a television newscaster said. At least the furor and wild fusillades aimed at the tower forced Whitman to slow up his own shooting. The anniversary of Whitman's murderous spree coincides with a new Texas law passed by the Republican-dominated legislature that allows concealed handguns on public university campuses, which includes the University of Texas. And if that were not contemptible enough, gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson has donated $500,000 to the country's largest gun lobby to fight against an assault rifle ban on sales to civilians by the Attorney General of Massachusetts. As a result of introducing the ban, State Attorney General Mara Healey has been slandered with online sexist and homophobic abuse. One misogynist gunatic tweeted his possible intent to hire a homeless man to rape and disembowel her. And twice now, Donald Trump has intimated the possibility of gun violence on a national scale if he doesn't win the presidency this November, with the false claim that his opponent, a woman, wouldn't you know, would abolish the Second Amendment. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, has a few words to say about the deluded psychoneurosis of America's gun culture. He asked if I might wish to share those words on this program. And afterward, I would like to repeat what Barbara Doherty had to say in the aftermath of the Columbine High School massacre in 1999. She was, at the time, president of Humanists of Washington State. I'll start with Guns Are Us by Robert Brake. Columbine, Newtown, Aurora, Charleston, San Bernardino, Orlando, Dallas. These cities will be forever etched into our collective consciousness and our country's track record of horrific mass shootings that left a total of more than 100 women, men, and children dead. We express our public outrage and sorrow, offer up our thoughts and prayers, mourn the lives lost, call for Do Something Now legislative proposals to prevent further tragedies, and resume our business as usual lives, rather than vigorously speaking up, taking to the streets, and becoming part of the solution. How sad. After Columbine, experts identified three common themes of mass shootings. 1, long-standing grievances by the perpetrator, 2, mental illness, and 3, access to firearms. Despite finding those same patterns from Sandy Hook to Virginia Tech, from Aurora to San Bernardino, the same questions always emerge. How did this happen, and how do we keep this from happening again? The answer is always, inevitably, more guns. Indeed, whenever America undergoes a tragic mass shooting, gun sales soar, and a majority of Americans insist that protecting their right to own guns is more important than controlling access to them. Pathetic. Now, it shouldn't take a Saturday Night Live skit to illustrate how ludicrous arming everybody is. Can you imagine a nightclub at 2 a.m. where hundreds of inebriated patrons fumble for their guns in the dark in a desperate attempt at vigilante justice? I can, and it doesn't end well. Witnessing a world growing more unsafe with each massacre makes owning a gun seem like the only viable option to many frightened and perhaps unenlightened Americans who currently own 300 million or more weapons. Forget for a moment that more than 60% of our gun deaths are suicides, not homicides, and that we have the highest suicide rate in the developed world. Forget that living with a gun actually increases your odds of death. Forget that a firearm is more likely to be stolen out of an SUV and used to rob a convenience store than it will be used in an act of heroism. Forget that children are 11 times more likely to be killed by a gunshot in the United States than in any other developed nation. And forget that for every gun used in self-defense, 6 are used in a crime. No. The lesson here isn't one of statistics. That's why in 1995 and 2015, the National Rifle Association persuaded the government to stop studying gun violence altogether. The 1995 law, banning government-subsidized research on gun violence, meant that agencies like the NRA and Second Amendment groups can now still claim, "We don't know enough about gun violence to warrant passage of gun control measures." Nifty logic here. The old standby of the gun crazies is that confiscating guns is the first step. The first step to our evil government crushing patriotic American gun owners. Just as the first kiss invariably leads to pregnancy, the single joint leads to heroin, and a Band-Aid leads to surgery. My mind falls faint. The answer is simple. It's good business. Gun and ammo manufacturers take in $13.5 billion, yes, billion, dollars a year. As is well known, the NRA, still adamantly claiming to be all about gun safety, is still joined at the waist with gun manufacturers, as securely as Chang and Eng, the famous Siamese twins. Really, you have to hand it to the gun industry. It's an impressive little sales cycle they have created. Every massacre draws attention to their products, yet somehow never to the people ultimately responsible for their production. So when the Colts and Winchesters run out of governments to sell to, they focus on marketing to us civilians, lots of us. The gun, once an agricultural tool in rural America, is marketed as a male totem, emotionally tied to masculinity, nationalism, and cultural myth, deliberately constructed for sales and marketing. The gun lobby may not have started out as villains, but the insidious propaganda and manipulation of our political system by lightning rod NRA spokesman Wayne LaPierre makes him as close to a Manichean villain as we can get. The gun industry has worked diligently to convince the American people that Obama is going to come for their guns. The gun industry answer to the problem? Drum roll, please. Buy more guns. gun-loving Americans can still purchase their AR-15s, 50-caliber rifles, 30-round capacity magazines, flamethrowers, and yes, machine guns, if the weapon was manufactured and privately owned before 1986, and the purchaser can pass a background check and pay a $200 tax. Tanks, bazookas, and grenades, however, are off limits. What's scary is that a small number of gun enthusiasts are stockpiling munitions. Some of them are paranoid, and some are delusional. Yes, a lot of crazy people have guns, and as many as 40% of them can buy guns without a background check via private sales, gun shows, or online. They are the ones who tell us it's in the Constitution, and we need to protect our families, forgetting that the Constitution was written a long time ago, back when the founders were imagining militias armed with single-shot muskets. We Americans are too stubborn, arrogant, and insulated to understand that every other developed nation has already solved or ameliorated the gun problem. Consider that in Japan, only 0.06% of citizens own a gun, all of whom attended an all-day class on gun safety, passed a written test, passed a shooting range class, and also passed a mental health examination, a drug test, and a background check. And they have to do that every 3 years. That's why they have fewer than a dozen gun-related deaths a year. Consider that Australia has had no mass murders since they confiscated 650,000 firearms in 1996. Consider that being killed by a gun in England is as likely as being killed by agricultural machinery in the United States. Also consider that the number of U.S. gun deaths in the last 15 years exceeds the number of Americans who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan and of AIDS, drug abuse, and terrorism combined. Or that the U.S. has only 4.4% of the world's population, yet owns nearly half of all firearms. Or that a 13-year-old in the United States cannot buy porn, cigarettes, alcohol, or lottery tickets, but could purchase a firearm. Yes, that old adage about people killing people, not guns killing people, is absurd. But that shouldn't come as a surprise, since it was scripted by the NRA. A more accurate rewrite would be, people with access to guns kill people. Add to that the federal government's defunding of mental health programs, resulting in many mentally ill people going undiagnosed and unsupervised. Combine that lackluster social safety net with under-regulated gun markets, and you have a perfect storm for senseless deaths. Although Orlando currently holds the record for the deadliest mass shooting in American history, it's only a matter of time before that record is broken. Other nations want to believe that the United States can be counted on to do what is right, but only after we have exhausted every other option. I think we have just about exhausted every other option. So maybe it is finally time to do what is right. I will continue to hold out hope, hope that someday Americans will come to their senses and do the right thing. And by the way, June 2nd, 2016, marked National Gun Violence Awareness Day, a day when there were 35 shootings, leaving 12 dead. Indeed, guns are us. And that was Guns Are Us by Robert Brake, who is an essayist and retired educator who lives in Ocean Park, Washington, on the Long Beach Peninsula, and he writes on many subjects of local and universal concern. And now, School Zone, Countering the Hysteria by Barbara Doherty. Columbine High School is an open, attractive, sprawling campus in the middle of a relatively safe suburban enclave in Littleton, Colorado. The school was a showplace when it opened, distinguishing itself in academics, music, drama, and athletics. Thus, it was an unlikely setting for a tragedy of the magnitude that took place April 20th, 1999, when witnesses say at least two students, 18-year-old Eric Harris and 17-year-old Dylan Klebold, killed 13 people and wounded 23 others before shooting themselves. Fellow students later said the group Harris and Klebold belonged to, self-proclaimed the Trench Coat Mafia, had been a target of derision for at least 4 years. Members were picked on, harassed, and excluded, always on the outside looking in. Most of the time, the members appeared to like it that way. As many cliques of young people do, the members played up their differentness. They wore army gear, black trench coats, and Nazi symbols. They spoke German to each other and were quite vocal about their fascination with Adolf Hitler and World War II. And April 20th, 1999 was Hitler's birthday. Membership in such groups is just one of a remarkable assortment of explanations and assignments of blame that panicked overreaction this tragedy has produced, accompanied by an onslaught of repressive solutions, allegedly designed to prevent recurrences. We are witnessing the institution of a myriad of alarming civil liberties violations, most aimed at obstructing the basic rights of young people, an already heavily restricted group of U.S. citizens. This is a classic scenario. Particularly shocking incidents of violence, especially those that involve young people, lead to mass hysteria and are invariably used to justify repressive government intervention. Fred Medway, psychology professor at the University of South Carolina, says people feel much more comfortable overreacting than underreacting. It makes them feel they've done something to prevent a potentially negative thing from happening. We are being told that the primary cause of the Columbine and similar tragedies is violence on network television and in cartoons, comic books, music, and movies. As usual, Hollywood is to blame. Next in line are various violent games, especially killing video games and violent toys. And of course, we must not forget that wildly dangerous and insidious corrupter of American youth, the internet, where Harris and Klebold are said to have got their bomb-making knowledge. It must be noted, however, that such terrorist know-how, complete with illustrated instructions for making bombs, is also frequently available in military manuals at surplus stores, as well as in numerous mail-order civilian manuals, which are available through some public libraries. Are proponents of censoring this information advocating that we somehow locate, remove, and destroy all these sources? Alexander Coburn addressed a closely related aspect of public reaction in The Nation. Quote, commentators have fastened onto the fact that one of the youths at Columbine had a personal website espousing an addled philosophy of violence. Those were the words of the New York Times editorial team, the same people who espoused an addled philosophy of violence a few days earlier when they suggested that NATO intensify the bombing of Serbia. Perhaps it wasn't a personal website the kid had in his computer, but NewYorkTimes.com. I'm not, of course, insinuating that the war in Yugoslavia caused the Columbine tragedy or any other instances of domestic crime. I am, however, appalled at the hypocrisy of those who blame such incidents on the media and popular culture while simultaneously ignoring the violence perpetrated by our own government. They ignore, too, that the institution most adept at putting guns in the hands of youngsters, many of them troubled, and training them to kill their fellow human beings is, of course, the U.S. military, which also insists on the right to accept teenagers at an age younger than most nations. It is amazing that those who are now blaming media violence for the Columbine tragedy, the president among them, can completely exclude sanctioned, even glorified violence of this magnitude from their analysis. Yet clearly they can and do fail to realize that, in order to maintain consistency and credibility, they must equally condemn all violence. This incredible feat of dissociation by government officials and the American public is so complete that no one noticed the appalling irony when the Air Force sent F-16s over the funerals of those killed at Columbine. In reality, and contrary to thousands of news sources, absolutely no causal link has been established between simulated violence in media and actual real-life violence. Just one example of how the media blatantly misrepresents this issue can be found in an Associated Press story that appeared a few days after the Columbine incident. It was picked up by most major newspapers under various versions of the headline, "Scores of Studies Link Media and Youth Violence." The story opens by referring to a bill in Congress to require the U.S. Surgeon General to conduct a comprehensive study of the effects of media violence on American youths, then immediately goes on to state that the evidence already exists. Finally, five paragraphs into the story, we read that a few scholars object to this research, saying the links do not prove cause and effect. Still, one after another, congressional representatives continue to pronounce that simulated violence produced by Hollywood is to blame for violence in our society. They then threatened government intervention to curb violence in movies, video games, and music if this is not done voluntarily. The obvious appeal of very alternative music, like many other forms of pop music, is that it gives voice to feelings of loneliness or anger shared by many young people, and usually serves as an outlet for these feelings. Out of the mainstream lifestyles, complete with music, provide a vital form of release. Many other seemingly antisocial behaviors are part of the rebellion we've come to accept as a normal and healthy part of the maturation process. Usually kids outgrow its self-destructive and counterproductive aspects. Similarly, although many video games do feature virtual guns and carnage, for all but a tiny percentage of young people, they serve as a means of blowing off steam, certainly not as a blueprint for actual killing. On the front page of my May 2nd newspaper was an 8x10-inch color photograph of four police officers in the main foyer of a local high school. Some are seen talking to students, others are standing guard, and so on. Certainly, I have no problem with students meeting and relating to police officers, but students becoming used to seeing police constantly monitoring their normal daily activities? How will this experience affect their perceptions and expectations of privacy? Many are so frightened they welcome this police presence, but what are the implications of creating citizens who feel safe only when directly watched over and protected by law enforcement personnel? One proposed solution to the school violence problem that is enjoying a surge of support is the concept of prosecuting parents for teenagers' crimes, which does not seem particularly ridiculous when in most states, until now, any 18-year-old could purchase a gun show pistol immediately. 23 states have extended some form of legal sanctions against parents whose children commit crimes, although rarely are these enforced. 13 states now have laws making parents criminally responsible for failing to supervise delinquent children, but again, rarely are such charges brought. 5 states have adopted laws threatening parents with fines or imprisonment for negligent parenting, although some have been struck down by the courts. Finally, there is one particular aspect of the American public's reaction to this tragedy that cries out for rational evaluation by freethinkers, as it is rooted in the irrationality of religion. We are subjected to pronouncements that the cause of Columbine and other violent episodes in schools is godless parenting and America's spiritual drift. Syndicated columnist Donna Britt actually wrote, quote, "Kids grounded in God often have more spiritual weapons with which to fight darkness. The beliefs of Christian kids," she maintains, "get media attention only when the awfulness is done in his name." When I opened my newspaper to the headline, "Deaths Seen Through the Prism of Christianity," I felt a chill. How much worse can it get, I asked myself. I discovered that several of the murdered students were eulogized at funerals and memorial services as Christian martyrs. Friends and family were quoted expressing how glad they were that these strong Christians had the privilege of dying for their belief in Jesus Christ. This is almost incomprehensible. Unflinchingly facing reality has never been more critical. There is no evidence that Christians or those who believed in God were selectively murdered. The Reverend Barry Paltzer, minister at the church of one of these Christian martyrs, was quoted as saying, "Inside that school library, they knew what they were doing. They knew what they were going after. That's what Hitler did." What planet are we on here? If these murderers had been adherents of Hitler's doctrines, they would have embraced Christianity and murdered only Jews, atheists, and others outside their faith. Christians are certainly free to comfort themselves with the fantasy that some of these youngsters were Christians who died for their beliefs, and to thank God they got to go out as martyrs. But it's just another delusion to avoid dealing with the simple truth. 12 beautiful young people and their teacher were in the wrong place at the wrong time, died tragically and needlessly, and are gone forever. The even less appealing truth is that we don't know why the murderers did what they did. We don't know why other incidents of school violence have occurred. We don't know if any one incident is meaningfully related to any other, or which incidents, if any, are related to which of a variety of factors in our society, nor do we know how to prevent future incidents. We certainly can and should continue sincere efforts to learn as much as we can, but we're a long way from any definitive answers. As we await further information from law enforcement officials, it is our task, indeed our duty as citizens, to resist panicked responses and stand in opposition to such tragedies being used to rationalize draconian violations of young people's civil liberties. And that was School Zone, Countering the Hysteria by Barbara Doherty. When she wrote this article for The Humanist in 1999, following the Columbine High School shootings, she was president of Humanists of Washington, executive director of Washington Coalition Against Censorship, and co-chair of the Northwest Feminist Anti-Censorship Task Force. The North Coast Times-Eagle reprinted her article in its September 1999 issue. And now, I'd like to read a poem by Juanita Huebner, "A Warm Gun." I am a woman who on occasion contemplates murder, today asking a clerk in a department store if she sold guns, ones which fire with grace. The bullet moves like a paper airplane and enters his flesh serenely, no blood, just a small hole and a slow wave going out from around it, as if it could be sleep, but it isn't. This has been Michael McCusker.